Confirmed cases of COVID-19 are racing towards 6 million, and more than 350,000 people have died across the globe. While COVID-19 has wreaked havoc the world over, history has proven and recent data agrees that the hardest hit will be the world's women and girls and populations already impacted by racism and discrimination. I'm Sarah Barnes, and you're listening to Friday Podcasts, hosted by the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program and Maternal Health Initiative. In today's podcast, brought to you through the generous support of EMD Serrano, a business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany, we share highlights from our recent Wilson Center event, COVID-19, Magnifying the World's Inequities. First, we have Katja Iverson, President and CEO of Women Deliver, a leading global advocate for investment in gender equality and the health and rights of girls and women, with a specific focus on maternal, sexual, and reproductive health and rights. Katja provides an overview of the impact of COVID-19 on women and the importance of women's leadership in this crisis.
Mortality of men is higher, but let me just emphasize that women play an outsized role in responding not only to COVID-19, but in many of the pandemics. In fact, evidence shows that disease outbreaks affect women and men differently, and that pandemics exacerbate gender and racial inequalities. We heard the numbers. Women account for 70% of the global healthcare workforce and the vast majority of social workers. They're also still the caregivers at home and mobilizers in their communities. We also know that people still have sex, need contraception during a pandemic. Women still get pregnant, wanted or unwanted, and still give birth. And they still have that human right to health. As this crisis intensifies around the world, it is clear that if we want to deliver health, well-being, and dignity for all, we really need to apply that strong gender lens to preparedness, response, and recovery, both to guarantee the unique needs of girls and women, but also to address the unique expertise is leveraged. And this includes positioning girls, women, and young people in all their diversity and in all settings, front and center in the emergency response, in the social and economic recovery efforts, and in how we strengthen our health systems for the long term. If we look at what some of the countries that have been dealing most efficiently and effectively with the pandemic, they have one thing in common, and most of them are led by women. We see it in Denmark, we see it in Taiwan, we see it in New Zealand, we see it in Germany. And everywhere they have, you know, kind of being empathetic and being kind doesn't mean you're not strong. So we have seen some of the most efficient responses there. And so if we look at long-term solutions, I'd say, oh no, let's rebuild a health system where we put empathy at the center of healthcare.
Next, we hear from Zahra Ahmed, Associate Director for Federal Issues at the Guttmacher Institute. Zahra shares estimates from the Guttmacher Institute on the impact of reduced contraception access on sexual and reproductive health outcomes and the policy actions needed to minimize this negative impact.
In the midst of this pandemic, bad policies and structural barriers may contribute to millions of people losing access to essential sexual and reproductive health services. Our team at the Guttmacher Institute estimated how sexual and reproductive health outcomes could change following only a modest 10% decline in access to care in 132 low and middle income countries, which together include over 1.6 billion women of reproductive age. The implications are staggering in terms of the needs left unmet, unintended pregnancies, unsafe abortions, and maternal and newborn deaths. Over the course of a single year, a 10% decrease in sexual and reproductive health services in low and middle income countries would lead to 49 million more women with an unmet need for contraception, 15 million more unintended pregnancies, 168,000 more newborn deaths, 28,000 more maternal deaths, and we could see 3 million more unsafe abortions and 1,000 more maternal deaths if just 10% of safe abortions are compromised. Now, these estimates are shocking, but the reality could be much, much worse if more than 10% of services are compromised or disrupted. Now, there's still time to act, but policymakers have to move quickly to avert this catastrophe, and they should prioritize 5 key actions. First, as Katya said, they must define and promote sexual and reproductive health care, including safe abortion, contraception, and maternal and newborn care as essential. This would allow people to travel for sexual and reproductive health services, even in areas under stay-at-home orders or with travel restrictions, without fear of legal consequence. Second, alongside private sector actors, they must shore up and strengthen the national and regional supply chains to make sexual and reproductive health medicines and supplies more accessible to both patients and providers. Third, they must make contraception available without a prescription, decentralize distribution, and facilitate multi-month dispensing of sexual and reproductive health pharmaceuticals. We have to make contraception available to people when they want it and where they want it. Fourth, we must adopt innovative models of care, including telehealth, as well as prevent diversion of resources and staff away from sexual and reproductive health care. And finally, and this is at the heart of our discussion today, they must address the unique needs of vulnerable and marginalized populations, including those living in humanitarian settings, as they're contending with barriers that are already being exacerbated by the pandemic.
Up next, we have Leila Sharafi, Senior Gender Advisor at the United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA. Leila spoke on the impact of COVID-19 on increased gender-based violence, especially for marginalized communities.
In terms of gender-based violence, we're seeing an increase, and this is because of isolation, lockdown, restricted movements, tensions in the households from financial and economic stresses. So we're really experiencing an increase, unfortunately, particularly of domestic violence. Now, before the pandemic, global estimates were that 1 in 3 women faced some kind of violence, gender-based violence. Well, now we're seeing, and again, early data showing us that this could be increasing anywhere from 20 to 35%. And reports are coming from countries in every region. So this is an issue that is being experienced everywhere, and it's not limited to any one particular place. So reports from France, from Spain, from Malaysia, from South Africa, US, UK, the list goes on, really. And it's really something that is striking. Although we know that in crisis situations, violence does increase, it's still very stark to see those numbers come in. And Sarah, as you mentioned, UNFPA published projections earlier this week. And as you noted, for every 3 months of lockdown, we can see a projection of 15 million cases of increased gender-based violence and 30 million for, let's say, 6 months of a lockdown. So the unfortunate situation is that the crisis comes, we know violence will increase at the very same time that services, resources, and attention are diverted. So there's that double kind of slam, right? So there has to be increased resources, number one. Now, this is challenging in resource-constrained environments, absolutely. But thinking about sort of the investment and where that goes in the response and preparedness is critical. Number two, and I think the most important, is to ensure that your services are adapted, they're flexible, and that the referral pathways for women and girl survivors are updated, and that the community and those women and girls who would need to access those services are aware of those updates, right? So where to access services as the pandemic hits, and let's say they're in lockdown or situations of quarantine. And when we're thinking about accessible services, we really need to ensure everything that we do is accessible to population groups like women with disabilities. In typical, let's say, non-crisis situations, women and girls with disabilities are up to 10 times more at risk of facing some kind of gender-based violence. So you can imagine when there's isolation, when they can't reach their regular caregivers, or they can't reach anyone because of disrupted routines, this can really increase. So it's really critical to ensure that our public health information and our services are thinking about them when disseminating information. I also want to talk very briefly about women and girls in humanitarian settings. IDPs and refugee women and girls face really high risk of gender-based violence, including sexual violence anyway. So in the situation of COVID, we have to be very careful to take that into consideration. We've seen from previous outbreaks like Ebola, for example, when there's economic devastation for women and girls, you can also experience sexual exploitation. And this is something to be really mindful of, particularly when we're talking about refugee women and girls who may be isolated, who may be in camps where attention, again, resources and services are diverted to deal with the magnitude of a COVID fallout. So this is really critical. And lastly, I also want to talk about Indigenous women and girls who also face higher rates of violence typically, and again, magnified and could be exacerbated in a situation under COVID pandemic. And I think it's really important to realize that Indigenous communities can be really, really significant partners in helping address the problem, especially within their communities. And I think this is a principle across the board, whether you're talking about disability or refugee women and girls or Indigenous women and girls, they have to be partners at the table, crafting the response.
How has COVID-19 impacted other existing inequities? Dr. Joya Crier-Perry, founder and president of the National Birth Equity Collaborative, spoke on the impact of COVID-19 on racial inequities, especially related to pregnancy and birth.
So we have three main root causes, and those are racism, classism, and gender oppression. And so we have a lot, and those oppressions love each other. So when they show up in different contexts, so if you're in another context, it might be casteism. It might be religious fundamentalism, especially if in a place like Louisiana, where I'm from, right? So other oppressions find ways to build on that. But we do know that Black women in the United States, despite income or education, are still more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts. So that's really where you see the overarching, how those inequities and those beliefs around hierarchy can come together in one space and cause people to die. So if I show up as a Black woman, even though I might have a PhD or an MD to your hospital, what you still see me as is someone who's not valuable. That's come from our textbooks, from the founding of our field of obstetrics and gynecology, right? So there's this belief that certain groups are here for us to experiment upon, to use. You see even now, there are hospitals and nursing homes in the United States that are giving people medications that they haven't even tested to say that they work, because we still believe we can experiment and try things on people who we don't value. We are seeing that people, birthing people across the United States for sure, are nervous, they're isolated, they don't have a lot of information, and we already underdiagnosed both pregnancy, postpartum depression, and postpartum anxiety pre-COVID-19 in this country. We didn't have an infrastructure for mental health, and so many birthing people would go home without support for their mental health, and so now we're exposing even how fragile that is. As a Katrina survivor my own self, I know we are going to have a world it's going to have PTSD after this. And so we know birthing people who had imagined that they were going to have people in the room with them, that they were going to celebrate, they were going to have come home and have grandma to cook and have family members to come over. None of that's happening. So people are grieving the loss of what they perceived their birth experience would be. And in that grief, they are traumatized, and we really don't have a structure to help them walk through that. So we are nervous around long-term what this will mean for birthing people during this crisis.
It is also important to hear from healthcare providers working on the ground to combat this health crisis. Now we hear from Dr. Neil Shaw, an obstetrician, gynecologist, and professor at Harvard Medical School, who is currently providing reproductive health services and delivering babies amid the COVID-19 surge in Boston. Neil spoke to his personal experiences serving the Boston community, particularly those living in Chelsea.
I am practicing at a tertiary center in Boston right now. This is the week that cases are surging in my city. And we serve the greater Boston area, including the city of Chelsea, which has some of the hardest hit neighborhoods in our entire state. And one of the things about this virus that's different from really anything we've ever seen. I mean, all viruses exploit our behavior in order to spread, but COVID-19 really preys on our instinctive need to be with each other during times of suffering. And that desire is exactly what makes it so deadly. It's a virus that spreads silently and visibly within people and across people. It geometrically multiplies with this imperceptible slowness while building in strength. And compared to other humanitarian disasters where you can see the suffering or at least the threat visibly and acutely, even compared to Ebola, where the people that we had to isolate were acutely symptomatic, this is different because of its invisibility as it's spreading and its slowness. Currently, we have to isolate people who are both symptomatic and asymptomatic, which is effectively everyone. And isolating everyone takes all of the existing inequities in our society and it throws them into a pressure cooker. And you know, we're seeing the impacts on pregnant people prenatally during labor and as they're home caring for their infants without very much support. 2 days ago, and really every week, I'm answering phone calls from scared pregnant people at home who are symptomatic. And one of the challenges that I'm seeing right now is that the biology of this disease and the sociology of this disease really interact. And the people that are historically experts in the biology aren't fully attending to the sociology. And honestly, vice versa. So right now, if people are mildly symptomatic, we tell them, even if we strongly suspect that they have COVID-19, that they should continue to isolate at home. And one of the challenges with that is that the people who are most likely to get infected are the ones that are least likely to safely self-isolate in the first place. When people call me, I have a set of criteria that's entirely biological about whether or not they're, you know, at enough risk to come into the hospital, but it doesn't take into account their living circumstances. Chelsea is a community, the hardest hit community in our state, that's has a lot of Latino immigrants that are living in multi-generational homes. And, you know, if I were, honestly, they should probably be at the front of the line to get prioritized for testing. But we don't really take into account their living circumstances.
Women make up the majority of the health workforce, especially as nurses and midwives, but are often not given leadership roles or involved in the decision-making process. Lastly, today, we will hear from Dr. Rupa Dutt, founder and executive director of Women in Global Health, on amplifying the voices of the female health workforce and women leaders in public health.
This is really very much a conversation about COVID-19 has disrupted business as usual on a global scale. But at the same time, this global tragedy is really giving us an opportunity to reimagine the future. So as we talk about the challenges, really important that we're also thinking about how are we going to be building back better. So what really inspired Women in Global Health to approach COVID-19 and really look at the gender equality dimensions is some of those numbers we've already heard is that 70% of the health and social workforce are women. But when you take a look at senior roles, women only make up 25% of those roles. And if this is really, a war, as often spoken about, then we really contest that women are the frontline soldiers in this pandemic, and they really do have the expertise and they should be at the decision-making table. Women, especially from the global south, are particularly underrepresented in global health decision making. They make up less than 5% of the most senior roles in global health. There's also an effort to democratize and decolonize global health, and these principles are really critical as we think and reflect about really building back better. And women really are the experts. They know the solutions. They're leading the fight against in hospitals, health centers, care homes, labs, in parliaments. We've already heard and seen acknowledgement of how women leaders that are head of governments are approaching the COVID-19 response differently, showing much more collaboration, much more social cohesion, looking into social protections, less divisive politics. Women health workers are quite rightly applauded in this pandemic. Their extraordinary resilience and commitment, but we also need to acknowledge that health systems were established by men for men. And Dr. Joya just talked a little bit about that earlier, but we, from a race perspective and a gender perspective, we need to acknowledge that the default health worker is now female and that women have different needs. Women make up majority of the workforce, but they remain clustered in the lower status, lower paid jobs, mainly the frontline. They also occupy most of the invisible lower status jobs as well. So we need to factor in that they're subject to more sexual harassment and violence as a result and are not part of the decision-making table.
Thank you for tuning in to this edition of Friday Podcasts, and thank you to our speakers for their expertise and valuable commentary. If you'd like to learn more about the Wilson Center's response to COVID-19 or listen to this event in its entirety, please visit www.wilsoncenter.org/maternalhealth or follow us on Twitter at @Wilson_MHI.